Today, we are diving deep into a simple, but honestly a pretty infuriating question. Why does that universal advice, you know, the thing that works for everyone else, sometimes actively make you worse? This whole thing kicked off for me with a story about a guy named James. He jumped onto the cold plunge trend like so many people.
Oh yeah, it's everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And you know the drill.
Yeah.
It's supposed to boost your energy, improve sleep, optimize your performance. He was consistent 2-3 weeks straight. But instead of optimization, he got the exact opposite.
Mm.
He was more tired, his anxiety spiked, and his sleep quality just tanked. And that was according to his tracker, but more importantly, this is how he felt. He kept pushing, thinking, oh, I just have to adapt, until it hit him. This is actively doing me harm.
That is the perfect, and I mean perfect, illustration of what we call the responder versus non-responder problem.
Right.
Almost all the advice out there, whether it's from a viral influencer, your doctor, even a peer-reviewed study, it's based on population averages. It's what works for the majority, maybe 60, 70% of people, and that's why it gets so popular. But if you, and I'm talking to you, the listener, if you happen to fall into that pretty significant 30 or 40% minority.
It's a huge minority.
It is. A minority that responds differently, or even paradoxically, where the benefit is actually a detriment. Well, then blindly following that average advice is basically self-sabotage.
So our mission today is to dig into that.
Exactly. We're going to explore the hard science of why we're all so different, unpack the biological reasons, and then give you a really rigorous framework to stop just taking advice and start becoming your own, you know, highly competent scientist.
I love that. And let's start with a historical parallel that just captures this perfectly. Back in 1952, the U.S. Air Force had a huge problem. Pilots were struggling with their equipment. Air rates were high.
Right, the cockpits were too complex.
Exactly. So they tasked this lieutenant, Gilbert S. Daniels, with finding a solution. His idea. Measure the average pilot and design the perfect one-size-fits-all cockpit. He took over 4,000 pilots, 4,063 to be exact, and measured them across 140 different dimensions. I mean, everything.
Mm.
Chest size, arm span, thigh length.
They were looking for Captain Average.
And what did he find?
He found zero. Absolutely no pilots fit the average across all 140 of those dimensions. Not a single one.
Not one.
So if you designed a cockpit for the average pilot, you were literally designing it for nobody.
That's the tyranny of the average in action. And it sounds so absurd when you put it like that with airplanes. Yet we do this all the time with our health.
We do. Population averages, they lie by omission.
So how does that play out today?
Well, take the research on habit formation. Everyone quotes that number. It takes, on average, 66 days to form a new habit.
66 days? I've heard that a million times.
We all have. But focusing on that one number, it completely misses the most crucial detail.
Which is what?
The range. The actual data shows that the time it takes for a habit to become automatic, well, it spans from a super quick 18 days.
18. That's really fast.
All the way up to 254 days.
Wait, 254?
Yes. That is an extraordinary 14-fold variation between human beings.
So if the range is that huge, why are we even talking about 66 days? Quoting the average just seems like you're setting people up to fail.
You are. And that is the painful practical outcome. If you are, let's say, a 180-day person, just genetically or psychologically a slow responder, you're going to quit at day 98.
Of course you are. You feel like a failure.
You'd be convinced you lack willpower or the habit just isn't for you. You quit because you compared yourself to an arbitrary number that your biology was still 2 months away from reaching. You didn't fail because of your effort. You failed because of bad expectations set by average data.
That 254-day number is, it's terrifying, but also so liberating. I think everyone listening right now is thinking back to a time they quit something way too early. Okay, so that's the population level. But what's actually happening inside our bodies? Let's get into the biology. Why does the same input give such different results?
The first place to look, and this one is always surprising, is inside our gut. The whole story with artificial sweeteners is a perfect example.
Okay.
For decades, the science was settled, right? Artificial sweeteners like saccharin, they're non-caloric, they pass right through you, they don't touch your blood sugar.
That's what I thought.
But these landmark Israeli studies, one in 2014 and another in 2022, they flipped everything on its head. They found that for about 40% of people, they called them the responders, saccharin caused clinically significant glucose intolerance.
So it spiked their blood sugar.
Spiked it as effectively as eating real sugar. The other 60%, the non-responders, had zero metabolic effect.
So it's not the molecule itself, the saccharin, that's good or bad. It's how your personal internal ecosystem deals with it.
Exactly. The difference was entirely down to their gut bacteria. The responders, they had these specific bacterial strains, like certain species of Bacteroides and Clostridium.
And the non-responders didn't.
They lacked them. So these specific bacteria, they metabolize the saccharin into compounds that actually mess with your liver's ability to regulate glucose. Same food, different biome, totally different metabolic outcome.
That's wild. So the practical implication here is what? We can't all get our gut sequenced tomorrow.
The implication is that your body's reaction is the only data point that matters. If you're tracking your blood sugar and some healthy food is spiking it, you now know it's a non-starter for your unique gut, regardless of what the general science says.
Your body's reaction is the ground truth. Okay, so let's shift from consumption to exposure. Things like intermittent fasting or cold plunges. They're popular because they're controlled stressors, right? Hormesis.
A beneficial stress, yes.
But what happens if you're already chronically stressed? Does that beneficial shock just become more noise that your system can't handle?
That is precisely the danger. Here we're looking at two major systems, the HPA axis, which is your main hormonal stress pathway, and polyvagal theory, which is about the state of your autonomic nervous system.
Your fight or flight system.
Right. And your baseline HPA function, it varies enormously from person to person. Your genetics, chronic stress, past trauma. All of this can leave your system dysregulated. You just have a lower capacity to absorb more stress.
So you're starting with a full cup.
A very full cup. So if you add another powerful stressor like skipping a meal for 16 hours or jumping into ice cold water, you can get this exaggerated, prolonged cortisol spike that you can't recover from properly.
And what does that look like in real life?
We saw it with a case study, Priya. She tried intermittent fasting religiously, but instead of focus and energy, she got persistent coldness, her menstrual cycle vanished, and her lab tests showed cortisol levels that were just through the roof.
So it was actively harming her.
It was causing thyroid suppression, crushing anxiety. For her, the intervention that was supposed to optimize was simply overwhelming a system that was already running way too hot.
That's a perfect paradoxical response. And it brings us right back to James, our cold plunge guy. The moment he stopped the plunges, his anxiety and fatigue just, they vanished.
Which is crucial. It confirms the plunges were the negative causal factor for him.
And he didn't give up on the idea of stress. He just found a different kind. He later found that heat-like saunas, hot yoga, that's what gave him the deep recovery and better sleep he was looking for.
He was a heat responder, not a cold responder.
Exactly.
And this paradox applies to psychological practices too. Take meditation, the standard focused attention meditation, the kind in most apps where you focus on your breath.
Yeah, the main one.
That is actually dysregulating for about 25% of people, a quarter of users.
A quarter? That's a huge number. So for them, it makes things worse.
It can. For that group, that intense focus can actually increase activity in the default mode network, the DMN, which is linked to anxiety and rumination. Their nervous system doesn't calm down. It speeds up.
So what's the alternative for them?
Those people often do much, much better with non-directive meditation, where you just let the mind wander. The lesson is always the same. You have to match the practice to your specific nervous system.
It really makes you appreciate traditional systems, doesn't it? The whole point of a guru or a healer was to customize the practice for the person in front of them.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking of something like Ayurvedic Prakriti assessment, which is all about figuring out your unique constitutional type before you even start talking about diet or lifestyle.
They were running complex N-of-1 trials, but intuitively, based on deep observation, they adjusted, they iterated. They didn't hand out a universal protocol because they knew the individual is the only data set that truly matters.
Which brings us to the solution for today. Most of us don't have a guru on retainer, so we have to become our own competent self-experimenters. This is the N-of-1 framework.
And this isn't about guesswork, it's about precision. Step one. You have to formulate a testable hypothesis.
So not just, I'm going to try cold showers.
No, way too vague. It needs to be specific. Like, I hypothesize that 60-second cold showers, 3 days a week for 6 weeks, will result in a 10% increase in my morning subjective energy score. You need something you can actually measure success or failure against.
Okay, so specificity is key. What's next?
Step two is a dual measurement strategy. You need both objective and subjective data.
Objective is the devices. Your ring, your glucose monitor, blood work.
Right. And subjective, which is non-negotiable, is your daily 1 to 10 reading of your mood, your energy, how you feel. And the discrepancy between those two, that's your most critical data.
How so?
If your sleep tracker says your deep sleep improved by 20 minutes, but you feel groggy and irritable, you have to trust the feeling. That objective score isn't measuring your ability to function and be happy.
And you need a starting point, right? A control.
Absolutely. Step 3, baseline and duration. You have to measure your current state for at least 2 weeks before you start anything. You need to know you're normal. Then, run the experiment long enough for changes to actually happen. 4 to 8 weeks is a good window. But the most important step, the one everyone skips, is step 4.
Which is?
The washout period. After the experiment is over, you have to stop the practice completely for 2 to 4 weeks.
Why is stopping it so important?
Because it confirms causation through reversibility. If your energy drops right back to your baseline when you stop, well, then you know the practice was the cause of the improvement for you. If the benefits stick around even after you stop, maybe something else was going on. Without the washout, you're just guessing.
It's a lot of tracking, but it's about getting real answers. This goes back to James, though. His device scores were actually a little better with the cold plunges, but he felt miserable. He trusted his feeling over the data.
And that's where we need to bring in the last piece of the puzzle. External observers.
Your friends and family.
Yes. We adapt to our own negative changes so quickly. We can become irritable or tired all the time and just stop noticing because it's our new normal. You need to ask your partner, your friend, hey, since I started doing X, have you noticed anything about my mood, my patience? They will see the subtle shifts long before you do. Their feedback is a necessary reality check.
So you're balancing this rigorous scientific framework with grounded human feedback.
Precisely. The goal isn't just better numbers on a screen, it's functional living. Are your relationships good? Do you have energy for the things that matter? You are the final judge of what actually works.
So to recap the core lesson,
mm-hmm.
Population averages can fail you because individual variation is just massive. Remember that 18 to 254 day range for habits?
It's huge.
To escape that tyranny of the average, you have to run careful N-of-1 experiments, use both objective and subjective data, and get outside feedback to see your own blind spots.
And one last thing. We're often focused on these huge short-term transformations, the 30-day challenge, the 41-day cleanse, but sometimes it's a much slower process.
Hey, Simi.
There's a story about Rebecca Chen who did this intense 41-day spiritual practice of Radha. She finished it, but she didn't feel that dramatic switch flip she was expecting.
She felt let down, like it didn't work.
Exactly. But her grandmother told her something interesting. She said it wasn't until her third or fourth year of repeating that cycle that she truly understood the benefits. So what if transformation isn't always a single event? What if, for you, it's a cycle you have to repeat until the practice finally clicks with your unique, slow-responding constitution? I want to encourage everyone listening to embrace the idea that you might just be a slow responder. Don't assume neutral data means failure. It might just mean you need to run the experiment again next season. Collecting data, even neutral data, is a success. It means you're learning the true, unique reality of your own body.